Okay, here we are. Welcome back. Glad to have you along tonight. Talking with Admiral Cooper about lots of things. His new book is coming out. If you go to Guests and pull up the photos, we're going to take a little journey down memory lane. We're looking at the second photo last, I believe, which is it reflects one of the darkest hours in American cultural, social, political history. It's absolutely horrible. And by all means, ready to go, Admiral. Picture number, what are we at, number three or four?
Well, number three was also the death camps, the starvation camps. Number four.
Now, I want you to look at these. Hold on. Look at this picture. Look at number three, everyone.
Yeah.
Now, do you see barracks buildings there? Do you see a dental office? Do you see medical facilities? Do you see a swimming pool?
No mess tent either.
Do you see a mess tent? What do you see? You see men who are about to die.
Yeah.
Who, if given a second chance, I wonder if they would have surrendered or stopped fighting.
Yeah.
If they had known
what was
in store for
them. I bet they would have kept on fighting. I know I wouldn't surrender if I knew this was in store for me, but they thought they were going to be treated honorably. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Horrible. Okay. Picture number four.
Okay, we're going to jump a bit here. Number four, that's chapter 12, which I mentioned was called Paintings by Rembrandt because our Sea agent Rembrandt was in Dutch Secret Service.
Uh-huh.
And we learned a lot from him, and you'll see it in this chapter. It talks about Kammler, it talks about Gestapo Müller. But if you look at photo number four, this is the big JU-390 that had a 7,000 or 8,000 mile range. This is a model you're looking at, of course. But in this chapter, you'll find that flip to photo number five. This plane, they had two of them in operation. V1 and V2 were their names. It had nothing to do with the rockets. They were flying to Japan from about early 44 or late 43. They were flying back and forth to Japan. And people right now are going to say, how could they do that? Because, you know, the airways were all covered. No, over the pole was not guarded by the Allies. So they were flying over the pole to, this is, I can't remember if it's the Kurile Islands or Sakhalin. But photo five, that's the airstrip from the sky. And flip on over to chapter six, or photo six, that's the runway. These photos were taken just about a year or two ago, and you see the circle. It's around a big pile of 55-gallon fuel drums, or in the German, it was 200 liters. And so now you flip to photo seven, and there's the marking on the top of them, Kraftstoff 200 liters. Gasoline or fuel, 200 liters, furgefahrlich, in other words, it'll blow up if you mess with it, and Wehrmacht, German military. These things are still sitting there today.
Dated. You know how much people would pay for those right now? Collectibles?
Yeah, I can imagine.
Look at that.
I can imagine.
They had to be somehow transported over there, maybe by ship, I don't know, and then stored at that strip. They were created and manufactured in Germany, and you see them. They're all there. That's just remarkable pictures. Yeah, I'd like one.
And
I'll take one.
Yeah, I can imagine. They're still sitting there. And there's more photos. I don't have too many more photos of this area in the book, but typical Germans, if they build something, they got to have tunnels and bunkers. This airstrip has tunnels and bunkers. I mean, the airfield has tunnels and bunkers running all over it. And it's now under control of Russia. That's part of the islands that were taken over by the Soviet Union at the end of the war.
Right.
And we got photos that some of the Russians sent here showing them in there. And there's also tunnels that go down underwater, and they got frogmen down there. That's not in this book, because we're just touching on this one function of it, not the whole shooting match. Uh-huh. But there's, you know, that's another part of the war that nobody knows about. How many people knew that they were flying to Japan all the time?
Correct.
Yeah. So, let's see. Let's hop around a little more. Let's go to photo 22. This one is really interesting. It's a, wait a sec here. That is, I lost my place. Hold on a minute.
Take your time.
Where are we? Okay, that's
sharkhunters.com is the email address. Don't forget
that.
All right.
Okay, chapter 11. And, this is the one, MK Ultra. Starts out, and like I say, Rembrandt was an active spook in a foreign agency. Actually, it was Dutch. And starts out with a photo of the house where Mengele, where Mengele lived, in Hohenau, Paraguay. We were there. I was there with our two doctor friends who really, really hot on the trail of on the history of Mengele and several others down there. It talks all about how Mengele was living with this other couple, and he had an affair with the wife, so they kicked him out. Imagine that. But then the interesting part, it goes on, and then it starts talking, it covers Mengele quite, I think, thoroughly, about four pages. We talk about Dr. Grüne. Okay. You'll find out who he was. And he got involved with the MK Ultra in CIA. For those who don't know what MK Ultra is, MK from the German mind control. They were doing mind control similar to the, the Manchurian candidate, teaching people how to, or controlling people's minds. And Skorzeny was down there in South America. Hans Ulrich Rudel, the great pilot, they were skiing in the Andes. There's a photo there of Skorzeny with his buddy Perón. But then it gets into, I'm scrolling pages, then it gets into MK Ultra. Wow. And how the German military was so strong down there. Pinochet, when he overthrew Allende, we saw, this was in 1989, because we had an apartment in Tampa. And the General Pinochet was reviewing the troops. The camera was behind and to the right of Pinochet, so you could see the right part of his body and his hand up in the salute, and his men were marching past in front of him. And I told my wife, I said, look at those uniforms. If they were black, you'd swear you were in Munich in 1936. And she says, yeah, look at the cuff on his jacket. And sure enough, he had a big, wide cuff, and it was all around it was German oak leaves, and right in the center was the Sig Ruhnen SS. I saw it on television myself. So then they had a place down there, which is in another chapter, Colonia Dignidad, which was founded by 300 Waffen-SS guys, started their own little empire, whatever you want to call it, in Chile, heavily guarded. You couldn't get in, you couldn't get out. And it was all Bavaria transplanted over there. But then I guess, well, he was, the guy Schmidt, I think his name was, who was the head of this group, and they were helping Pinochet because thousands of Allende supporters were brought into the camp, into Colonia Dignidad, but they never came out. But then apparently, maybe 15 or so years ago, they figured he outlived his usefulness, so they brought charges against the guy in charge for being a pedophile. Now, whether that was true or not, I have no way of knowing, but it seemed odd that he was there for 30, 40 years and nobody thought there was a problem, and then all of a sudden, when they don't need him, that's it. So, yeah. And one of our members was involved in Paperclip, which had to do with scientists going to the U.S. and also down to South America. That was Heinz Schlicker. He was a little bit involved with the MK Ultra. But if you look, yeah, there you go, Project Bluebird, Project Artichoke, interrogation techniques, including hypnosis and drugs. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look. Oh, yeah, Richard Helms, you know who that guy was. He was head of CIA back then.
Yeah.
And let's look at the pictures again. There we go. Picture number 24. It's Candy Jones, not her real name. But she's a gorgeous, gorgeous young woman. And as I put in our Hotmail that went out last week, mm-hmm. you know, you can go to the public library and check out a book, or two books, whatever. In this group, I won't say CIA, but in this group, you could check out a woman like this to use for a night or a weekend, whatever. They had a whole raft of these women who were drugged and were used. Figured out what that means. And then we look at 25. That lady was rescued by the guy on the other side of the dog. They got married. He was a CIA guy. Huh. And he rescued her. I can't remember what her name was, their name, but I spoke to them on the phone.
She was a sex slave.
Yeah, absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And these controls for controlling human behavior under MKUltra included radiation, electroshock, psychology, psychiatry, sociology, anthropology, graphology, harassment, substances, paramilitary devices, I don't know what the hell, and LSD. So I'm scrolling through my chapters. I'm trying to get to that.
You're good.
Ladies. Here we go. The mastermind manipulators, past and present, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, Richard Anderson, Dr. John Lilly, Dr. William Bryant, Dr. Martin Orne, the list goes on. And the sponsors included Cornell, Duke, Princeton, UCLA, University of Rochester, MIT.
They do anything for a grant, anything for money. No,
apparently,
there's no morality. No, none.
Yeah, money, money, money. So there was a book came out in Playboy Press entitled The Control of Candy Jones. That was that tall, slim girl we saw.
Yes.
It shows about her 12 years of intrigue and suspense with the CIA. Her birth name was Jessica Wilcox, came from a low-income family, mm-hmm. and born 31st of December. Her father deserted the family, and she won Miss Atlantic City Beauty Contest. And there's a lot more to the story. Here's the picture.
So how much of this is in the book?
Pretty much all we're talking about so far.
Good.
Wow. Now, the picture of the guy and the girl with the big moppy dog, Kathy O'Brien is the girl, and she is the
That's
only
when she
vocal,
was still a blonde. Interesting.
I guess. Well, this is a different girl, not Candy Jones. This is Kathy O'Brien.
No, Kathy O'Brien. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, and she's the only vocal and recovered survivor of the CIA's MK Ultra project, Project Monarch, mind control operation. And that guy was the CIA guy who rescued her. They got married, and I spoke to them on the phone. Oh, geez, a million years ago, probably 25, 30 years ago. And his name is Mark Phillips. He rescued...
That's Mark. Okay, that's Mark Phillips. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know this whole story.
Okay.
I didn't know that that's what he looked like, though. Interesting.
Okay, that's Mark Phillips. Yeah. I spoke with them many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And they confirmed everything that pertained to them in the report, but when I requested an in-person filmed interview, no, they said, no, they'd prefer to keep their peace and quiet. And I can't say as I blame them.
Keep their health.
Yeah, they like to keep living.
Right.
And so the last picture of this group, picture 26, it's a place called Bohemian Grove, in California. It's still going today, so I'm not going to say any more about it, but you can read about it.
Oh, most people know that listen to this program have at least a working knowledge of the Grove and what they do there. It's pretty hideous. These are the Satanists of this planet. They get together there, just like they do at Davos, but it's more pointed at the Grove,
yeah.
I think.
Good old Davos. I'm sure you must have seen Al Gore and his screaming and ranting.
No, I didn't. I don't. No, I missed it. I don't know if I missed anything.
Well, you didn't miss a lot, except the guy was on meltdown, and he refers to millions of Hiroshima-type bombs. There's no such place as Hiroshima. The press has changed the pronunciation from Hiroshima to Hiroshima, and there is no such place as Hiroshima. One of our members, who's now passed, he was a Japanese spy. His name with us was Marco Polo. I asked him about it, and he was laughing. It's what is so funny. He says, there is no such place as Hiroshima. That's just Americanization of Hiroshima.
Man.
So, anyhow... excuse me. What shall we look at next? Let's see.
By the way, the Bohemian Grove is well known, and that's how Alex Jones first made his big appearance and his big notoriety step.
I didn't know that.
By sneaking in there with a camera, a video camera.
Jesus, I wonder he didn't get killed.
I don't, for a minute, believe they didn't know that Alex Jones was in there with a video camera.
Okay.
But that isn't the idea was that footage of their one of their rituals, the big owl on there, and then they call it the cremation of C-A-R-E, care, is what was going on. They don't care. Care is for wimps and sissies, so they cremated. And it's kind of just a ritualistic thing. Anyway, he videotaped that and released it, and that immediately made Alex Jones a household word among the alt-news community. But I think, frankly, that they knew damn well he was in there with a camera, and they were going to establish him, which they did establish him, and InfoWars, over the next years as one of the three major platforms that they run and control right now for so-called alt-news truth. But in fact, these are deep state operations. Always have been, nothing new. And the most recent of which, I'm not going to mention any names, but you know who I'm talking about. They're all contrived. They're created. They're designed. They're put out there with good information, so they bring people in. And just remember the 80-20-20-10 rule. You can have 90% 20-10. That's 80-20. 90-10. You can have 90% good stuff and then 10% spin. And that's how they do it. They build their credibility, and then they start putting their crap in there. So it's very difficult to make your way through the world of alt news. It's very hard now. Most everyone is either bought off, created, and or a willing participant with the agenda because it benefits them in one way or another or several others. It's very hard to find good, consistently good news out there. By way of honesty and accuracy. Go ahead.
And if you go the way we did, which was straight up honor and honesty, you wind up on the blacklist of the Southern Poverty Law Center, otherwise known as the Spitlickers. And, you know, it's cost us a lot, but I wouldn't tell. Of course, they're listening to this show right now. I know it. But I was supposed to get an honorary doctorate, and they Googled, oh, God, no, he's a Nazi. Get him off of here. And then,
hey, I've had the same thing. Exactly. People will go looking under my name, and they'll find a shitload of lies and complete fiction and corruption of reality. There's no.
No, it must
and
I be had to true make a or they wouldn't publish it, right?
Right. I had to make a decision, and I've said this before. Do I waste my time, you know, responding to this crap and trying to set the record straight, or do I keep doing my work? And I just said, to hell with them. They can put whatever they want. I don't care. And they stop pretty much, but it's there, and anyone can find it. And they'll, oh, my God, this is a terrible person. You've been there. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, like I say, I was a charter member of the International Press Club of Chicago, and they Googled it after I was there for 4, 5, 6 years. Oh, kick me out. So then I went to apply for the National Press Club, and they said, oh, my credentials were great, not a problem. 3 weeks later, I get an email.
Sorry.
No good. Don't ever call us again.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they own it all, so it's pretty easy to. I mean, I used to try to, not one word on the wiki page about yours truly is true, or not one word has been written by me. That's the truth. It's all them. They write the whole thing. I've tried many times years and years ago to edit and correct the inaccuracies and the lies, and within seconds their crapola comes right back up. So there's no use.
We had when my book Hitler in Argentina first came out, people were reading it and they had great comments on the Amazon page, and every single positive comment, some little fudge packer in England, Roger, I won't mention his last name, he had to write a one-star negative comment on every single positive review.
Response. I got it.
So then we got a photo of him and details that he was a, how shall we say this? He batted for the other team. So we let him know that he probably ought to shut up, or we'll do an expose on him and his unusual existence.
Yeah, well,
never
people
heard from
just,
him again.
Good. They need to walk into the Internet with eyes wide open and understanding that they're about to be served up with some of the most sophisticated trickery and deception that you would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very dangerous out there to go in there and read and believe what you're actually seeing. You can't do it. You got to put an asterisk and a conditional acceptance on everything you read, and then make your own decision over time.
And you got to try to double, triple, and quadruple check it and cross check it. My daughter, as you know, has a master's degree, and she said when she was going for, I think even for her bachelor's degree, her professors told her and the whole class, we don't accept anything that you get off the Internet, because they know it's all full of bullshit, if I can say that on your show.
Yeah, sure, it's fine.
So,
no problem.
You know, it's great disinformation. Hold on a sec. Okay, I'll come kiss you goodnight in a minute, son.
Yeah.
My son just popped up to say hi to me.
Good.
He's the reason I get up in the morning. He's the reason the sun comes up in the morning, that guy.
Wonderful. Very good. Okay,
so anyhow,
onward here.
Onward, upward, forward, together. That's the motto of the Bahamas. Chapter 6, The Slender Thread, German-Japanese Cooperation and Communications in World War II and the Indian Ocean Fulcrum. That's part of somebody's doctorate.
Picture number.
Hold on. It's a picture of George Orwell. Where are we?
Got it. That's number
there
11.
There we go. Photo 11. Dum, dum, dum. And that was not his real name, you know. George Orwell. I forgot what his name was.
I can't remember.
Big, long British name. But this guy who wrote this part was a member of Shark Hunters, William Corr. Uh-huh. And he lived in Japan, researched, studied, et cetera. And let's see, this is what George Orwell said. The German and Japanese have evidently staked everything on this maneuver in the confidence that if they can bring it off, it will have won them the war. That was the best supply route to Russia through the Persian Gulf. Well, that got shut off. But he was talking about the wartime link between National Socialist Germany and Imperial Japan, which was the slenderest of threads. We've read in so many places that cooperation between those two countries just really was strained at the most. The Japanese had an officer in a particular position, and he would not talk to the German counterpart if he was of a lower rank. So a lot of Germans had to be promoted up just so they could talk to the Japanese. Yamamoto, this was before he got shot down. One of our members, incidentally, was in the squadron that shot down Yamamoto.
It's all part of war, but that whole thing, that episode of how they stalked him, basically set him up, or it wasn't, they didn't set him up, but they did. I don't, war is war, but that was a murder. They murdered him.
Well, what's the difference between a murder and an assassination?
That's right.
This is something here that I'm going to read you this verbatim from William Corr. And remember, he's an expert on this. Author's right. Note. The veracity of the apparently apocryphal tale of abandoned or purchased babies being fattened, killed, cooked, and subsequently devoured by hotel guests in wartime Macau was confirmed by Monsignor Manuel, I can't pronounce the last name, the distinguished historian of that city. The Hotel Central in the Avenida, whatever that address is, was the hotel. The number of babies fattened, slain, and served is unknown. As an eyewitness, Manuel, whose name I can't pronounce, also confirms that cannibalism was widespread in the city itself in the war years. And it came from personal communication of that fellow I can't pronounce, 7 February of 1996, and an interview with him, 21 July 96. Fattening babies to eat them.
I hate to say this, but the Chinese in Macau were obviously doing that then, and that wasn't restricted to Macau. Furthermore, they are still serving fetuses in various restaurants in Japan. There have been videos snuck out of Japan or otherwise made available that show people with a small, tiny baby cooked up on a platter at the dining table in a restaurant. No joke.
Are you saying still today?
Yep.
Oh, Jesus.
Cannibalism, by the way, is making a comeback, and there are many restaurants. I don't know how many is many, but there's more than a few restaurants in this country, in big cities, that if you go in and you know what to ask for, you can get human flesh. They serve it.
Good Lord.
It tastes like pork. That's what they say.
I thought everything tasted like chicken, but anyhow, I don't know.
No, it's true. You can get it in restaurants.
Oh, I believe
in the
you,
US
but
right now,
whatever restaurant that is, I don't need to go there.
No,
holy cow,
you wouldn't go there. It's not, they're not 5-star restaurants necessarily.
No, I can imagine.
But they have things on the menu that, for those who are interested in that, they know. They know where to go and what to get. It's more practically available than you'd think. It's not a very hard thing to get, apparently, from what the people that I know tell me. And if we really hit the fan here, there would be a lot more of it than
I suspect. Yeah, I imagine. When necessity hits, what the heck? Think about the Donner Party.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
And we're being set up. I guess the next hour we'll talk more about the planned famine that's coming. We find out now that the U.S. government was behind almost all of those food processing plant fires in the last year. This alleged government of ours was behind it all.
Yeah,
just implementing globalist war plans on how to destroy this country. That's all they're doing. We don't have a government anymore.
Before I came on with you, I was watching Tucker Carlson. I'm surprised that guy hasn't committed suicide or had an accident or something. He's come on explaining how it started back in the days of Nixon, who was a very popular president, and they forced Spiro Agnew out, and they stuck Gerald Ford in there, and Bob Woodward, great journalist? No, he wasn't. He was a naval intelligence officer who was then, after he got out of the Navy, was working for the CIA, and the CIA put him into the New York Times, and that's, the whole thing was contrived, and ever since then, according to Tucker Carlson tonight, they've controlled everything there until, Trump got in, and he realized the hard way that the swamp was a lot bigger than he thought, and now accordingly they're starting to throw Biden under the bus with all these documents, and so they're going to start leaning on him to make sure he doesn't run again. And then they're talking about, this was on Tucker Carlson's show, the 2024 Democrat bunch will be Gavin Nauseam and Michelle Obama.
That's what he said. Yeah, I knew about Michelle. I'm going to have Joel Gilbert on tomorrow night, who wrote a book about Michelle Obama running for president. So it'll probably be Gruesome Newsom as vice president and Michelle as president. That's what they're thinking.
Boy, we'll see.
Yeah. Joel will be on tomorrow night. For everyone out there who's interested, and he's really put a lot of work into this. He has a documentary out on Michelle, or Mike Robinson, however you will.
And he hasn't committed suicide yet either, huh?
No. Not yet.
Now, you get...
Joel's a good filmmaker, and I don't know...
Guys at his level and my level, we're not dangerous enough to where we have to be clipped.
Well, Joel put out the best political documentary I've ever seen about Obama. It's called Dreams of My Real Father, or something very close to that. You can find it, Joel Gilbert. And I think it's available online. And if you want to see the truth about Obama, that's the place to find it. And whoever his sources are knew exactly what they were giving him. And they had it all.
You mean he really wasn't born in Kenya?
Oh, his father was not a goat herder in Africa. No. His father was the communist Frank Marshall Davis, who was living in Hawaii. And he had a penchant for convincing white women to pose nude for his camera. And he knocked up Barry's mother, and that's where Barry came from. And Frank Marshall Davis.
I sent you the three photos of his mom nude there that was taken by Frank, what's his name?
Yeah. Well, Davis spent years with Obama during his teenage years, instructing him in communism and Marxism. That's how it worked.
learned well, didn't he?
Yeah. He's still running the White House now, so.
Yeah. He's
Susan
pulling
Rice
the strings.
And, yeah. Valerie Jarrett, they're absolutely pulling the strings. Who's pulling their strings, though, is the interesting story.
Yeah.
They can figure out to a degree.
We're finding out. I'm still surprised. I'm finding out how intertwined everything is. Ronna McDaniel, the head of the Republican National Committee, they're trying to kick her out because they think she was responsible for the debacle in the last few elections, which may or may not be true. She's Mitt Romney's niece, for God's sake.
All in the family.
Yeah. And Gavin Newsom there, that's Pelosi's.
Nancy's nephew.
Nephew. Holy cow.
Look, we don't have a representative government of, by, and for the people. No, it's of, by, and for them and their controllers. This country's been overthrown.
Well, according to what Tucker Carlson said, it started when they went after Nixon.
He's got really... he's the only one, Laura Ingraham to a lesser degree, but they throw us a bone to keep us thinking that this is a free and open society and information exchange. Tucker is the number one lighthouse in the dark for those seeking the truth in the mass media. He's got writers. They write what they're told that they can write. This is all obviously controlled. Not knocking Tucker at all. He's a reader. He works too hard every day. He's got his own daytime show. These are writers that put together that monologue in the evening. He doesn't write all of those. I'm sure he writes some of them.
Yeah.
But no, this is written for him. This is to keep us thinking, well, we've got a chance.
Yeah. I know. I used to be on television a million years ago, you remember.
Yep, I do. I was an anchorman news director for 12 years.
Oh, right, yeah. And, of course, Dick Allgaier, he was a big-time reporter in Hawaii.
37 years.
Well, but he's, I think the reason he stopped is because he wasn't for sale.
No, he stopped because of his head injury.
No, I didn't know about that.
He suffered a very severe brain injury. Not too many years before I did, when I'm in that car wreck. But
I remember your car wreck. You sent me the photo array.
Yeah. He had to retire. He couldn't work. The brain damage was bad. He's recovered. He's fine. He's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. He's in great shape. You know, he's a good man. He's been a member of Shark Hunters for almost as long as you. And we have a great time chatting, you when you and I get together.
Yeah. No, he's a good man. All right, the name of the new book, Mr. Cooper, is Admiral Sir, again, to keep everybody on the same page.
It is called Hidden Secrets of World War II, and it's available now. Go to sharkhunters.com, go up to the shop, and then to books. All our books are there, including this one. We got 52 books in print now.
That's all, huh?
Damn. Yeah.
Wow.
And I've got four more that I'm working on now that should be done by the end of this month.
Be done by tomorrow morning, you said?
Pretty close. No, actually, after I get off the air with you, I'm going to bed and I ain't getting up for 24 hours. I've been fighting this doggone cold here, and I just need to chill for a while.
Gotcha. All right.
You know, in Florida, you know, people think Florida's, you know, hot and sunny and palm trees and sandy beaches and beach bunnies running around. No, that's down in the south part of Florida. Here we have rolling hills, we have oak trees, and we have racehorses. Four Kentucky Derby winners came from within 50 miles of me. And it's beautiful, it's pleasant, it's warm. But a couple of days ago, we had a cold snap, cold for here. It got down into the mid-20s. And that always knocks the hell out of me. So,
yeah,
that's cold.
I'll be damned.
We had to scrape ice off the windows of the car. So, but it's back nice and warm now, and I'm still recovering from this doggone cold. So anyhow, if you want to get back to where we were looking,
yeah, we got to get. I promise we get through these pictures. Go ahead.
But we ain't going to get through them all in the next 13 minutes. But photo number 12, that's a guy named Subhas Chandra Bose. And apparently he was the founder of Bose Sound Systems.
That guy?
One of our members is a sound technician with them.
So that's where it
awesome.
Came from.
Yeah, no awesome products. I mean, they got awesome sound. Well, this guy, Subhas Chandra Bose, it talks about him in this chapter. Uh-huh. He went to Germany and talked to Hitler for a little bit, and then some of Hitler's underlings. He wanted permission and a blessing or whatever to go back to Japan and get a lot of the Indian prisoners, because India was a possession of Great Britain. And so the Japanese captured a bunch of Indian soldiers who were fighting for the Brits, and they were in POW camps. Subhas Chandra Bose wanted to recruit a bunch of these guys into the Indian National Army and fight alongside the Japanese against the Brits. And they were promised their own homeland, in India. They were going to carve out a chunk of India, assuming Germany and Japan were going to win, which didn't work out so well. But, again, just to show how inhuman and brutal and you know what the Japs were, they told these Indians, okay, sign up over here. And a lot of them did. I think it was about 20,000 did. Some said, no, we'll just stay here in POW camp. So what they did, they used some of these guys for live bayonet practice while their buddies were watching. And then they asked them again, do you want to sign up or do you want to stay here for a while? So they got, I think, three or four divisions. But the problem was they were not fighting alongside the Japanese. The Japanese would send them in first as shock troops, and they were suffering horrible casualties. And then, lordy, lordy, it must have been an accident, I'm sure. He got sent over on board U-180 from Germany to Japan. That was a very rare Type 1 or Type 9 D-1. Only two of them were ever built. And one of our members was the medic, the corpsman, on board that boat, so he got a chance to talk to Bose quite a bit. And then he went into the Indian Ocean and gave Bose over to a Japanese sub. And then he went there and was recruiting the Japanese or the Indian National Army, et cetera. And things were not going to his liking. Like I say, his guys were being used for the cannon fodder. So he was going to go back to Germany, I guess, and he was going to fly to the coast and catch a submarine back. His airplane fell out of the sky. Doggone how them accidents happen. He wasn't killed in the crash, but the fuel tank ruptured and he was totally doused, soaked in gasoline. Poof. That was it. He blew up. Accidents happen.
I had no idea that Bose was an Indian name.
Yeah.
I thought it was German. Like
nope.
Grundy or something.
Subhas Chandra Bose.
Oh, I gotcha.
Excuse me.
Wild.
And we'll skip over the Yamato and then look to photo 14. There are records that one of the JU-390s, it was probably V-1, flew to within 20 miles of New York and returned back to, well, they were based in Norway at Vardafoss. And that's an artist depiction of it.
That's probably actually a very close rendering of what happened. Whether it was in daylight hours or at night, doesn't matter because the plane was there. It overflew New York, apparently, to a degree. That's remarkable. Notice how that doesn't have a single rear stabilizer. That's odd. It's got twin vertical stabilizers.
They did that a lot. The Ju-390, the Ju-290, the FW-200, they all had, I think, I'm not sure, but I think that's the way they were, going off the top of my head. They used those double stabilizers in the back. Maybe, you know, maybe they get better control. I don't know. It just seems like there's more that can go wrong.
I don't know. The planes were great. They were great aircraft.
Well, yeah, that one went all the way down to Uruguay with Uncle Adi on board.
Yeah. Yep. And don't forget that a lot of our, I've mentioned this before, but an entire P-51 squadron of pilots was kept in Europe at the end of hostilities and retrained on DC-4s.
Yeah.
Douglas Aircraft DC-4s. And
yeah,
I knew somebody whose best friend
was a C-54. Right. Sorry.
Yeah, it was one of these pilots. And the DC-4 was a four-engine, long-range transport, and they put extra fuel tanks on it. And they flew. These P-51 pilots flew. They were never allowed to look in the back of the plane. But every day, they'd load up with lots of German men and women, children, and other cargo components, and they'd fly and stop in the Canaries and refuel and then make it all the way across to South America. We flew a lot of German government and military and business officials and their families to South America. Many more came by ship, but we flew them in DC-4s. This guy I knew, and his best friend was one of these pilots. He said, I only made two flights. Most of my squadron mates made many more than that. He only made two. I don't know why, but he confirmed all of it.
I think that was part of the quid pro quo to get all
the
scientific.
Yes. Trade the technology for freedom for various and sundry numbers of Germans in the military and the government.
Right, and taking a far step off the center line here, we all know that. Jodl, Keitel, et cetera, they were all hanged at Nuremberg after the tribunals. Not trials, tribunals. And we all know that. And we all know that they were cremated, because history said so. And we all know that their ashes were thrown in the river. No, they weren't. As you know, I think I told you many, many years ago, Pizarro and I found where Jodl's remains were, and they're, I won't say exactly where, so
in
we don't
cemetery.
Have problems. Huh?
In a cemetery. Where did they bury him?
In the crypt underneath a convent.
Oh.
He
several
and I
were
went
put
this,
under there.
Not yeah, and I, probably the other guys were there, too, and I think because, you know, the Americans were Christians, and they didn't think it was proper to throw the ashes in the river, whatever the reason. But 2 weeks after the execution, Frau Jodl moved to within a couple of miles of this convent, which is way at the other end of Germany. And so Pizarro researched, and the behind the 14th century altar in this big church, there was a huge tapestry, and allegedly behind that was a steel door, a modern steel door. And 3 meters inside was another modern-day steel door. So we were walking around this convent, and you could see the convent was up on about a six-foot berm all the way around. Right. And Pizarro, I have always said that the Germans had great soldiers, great military people, but their spy service was not all that hot. He goes up to this little 20-year-old nun in the convent, and he introduced me as his friend from the CIA, and asked her where Jodl's remains were. Okay. At that point, you know, this girl wasn't even born at the end of the
Jodl
war. I mean,
who?
She was
right.
Yeah, that was like 30 years later she was born. So what would she know? No, she went into a big, long historical story about they were tried, they were hanged, they were cremated, et cetera, right out of the history book. So we went outside, and I said, you know, that's not the way to do it. So I saw a workman coming by, and I didn't speak German at all back then. So I said, ask this German, where's the doorway to the crypt? And he says, well, no, we should ask him if there is a doorway. I said, no, don't give him a yes or no question. Ask him where it is. So he asked him where was the doorway to the crypt. And this workman, without batting an eye, said, yep, it's in there behind the 14th century altar. So he and I went in there, pulled back the tapestry. There was a modern steel door. You look through the big keyhole. 3 meters further on was another big steel door. But we couldn't get anybody to go get the key. Nobody wanted to do that. But there was a, right outside the door to this convent, there's a big stone about, 3 feet across, I guess, with the name Jodl chiseled into it professionally. And like I say, his wife, his widow, moved there 2 weeks after the execution. So I got to believe his remains are there for sure, and probably the other guys too.
I would think so.
Yeah. So we just keep going on and on and on, turning over one stone after another, and we're publishing it as fast as we can.
Wow. What a story it all is, the truth. It's so much more fascinating than the crap that they feed us when you find this out.
Yeah, but unfortunately, everybody believes the history that they've been told because they don't have any interest in looking for the truth, and they don't have the time to dig for it either. They got a job.
Those days are over. They're trying to survive now.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the case.
Yeah.
As we are here, geez, my wife went out to buy a dozen eggs. She said just about 6 months ago they were 99 cents a dozen. Now they're almost $7 a dozen.
Yeah, they're $9.50 here.
Oh, geez. Well, you know.
I get the organic ones, so they're a bit more. But
okay, but you got to pay them chickens minimum wage. That's what the problem is. Chickens got to get minimum.
$5 for a can of beans.
I know it. My
true
wife
story.
Picked up some NyQuil for me because I got this cold. Mm-hmm. $10. $10 for a bottle of NyQuil. Jesus.
I just get some Jack Daniels. Take a couple shots. You'll sleep.
That's what my wife said I should have got. I said, well, you're the one that went out and bought the NyQuil. Why didn't you just tell me to take the black Jack Daniels?
There you go.
So I'm not sure what I'm going to do after I get off the air.
Go to bed.
Yeah, but I got to take either NyQuil or Jack Daniels.
Well, who said you have to do either?
Maybe both.
Why not?
I don't think that'll work. Not both of them.
Well, there's alcohol in the NyQuil, so.
Oh, there sure is. Knock you for a loop.
I would just stay with one then. Don't play games. But if you wake up at 4 in the morning and you don't want to wake up and you want to go back to sleep, take some Jack.
Yeah, except tomorrow is a work day. I have to get up to get my son his breakfast. And since I get up early anyhow, I get Sean up at 10 minutes till 6. I start tea for my wife at 10 minutes till 6. So, you know, she takes care of me pretty great. So it doesn't hurt me to start her tea water at
That's
6
nice.
O'clock. But then I go right to work.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, she's a great lady. She put up with me for 37 years so far. I wouldn't put up with me for 37 minutes.
That's funny. It's true. Yeah, no, she's something special for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. The book is Hidden Secrets of World War II. The place to go is sharkhunters.com.
Get
it. And prepare to be taken on quite a joyride of truth. It's fascinating. So there.
A lot of fun putting it together. I learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, I can tell. And this is going to be the first of many. So Go get some sleep and get well.
I'm going to. I'm going to finish my coffee. I'm going to give my son a kiss goodnight, and then I'm going to go look at the inside of my eyelids.
Good job. Thank you, Admiral. As always, Harry, we'll talk soon. You be well.
You betcha. My pleasure, okay. Jeff. Have a great day.
Thanks. Good night. All right. Harry Cooper, the one and only. Back with more right after this.